TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I came to give you my best, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about skin lotions today. But first, I hope you'll enjoy this bottle of your favorite Synthil that I just happen to have with me.
Is this a setup, Chris? You've given me skin lotion and Syntha. What is going on here, my friend? What is going on?
It sounds like something that may have also happened down in the Arboretum on the surface of Bajor at some point during today's episode.
Yes, we have so much to talk about in this episode of Deep Space Nine as we continue with the Circle trilogy. Oh my goodness. This is a happening episode.
It really is. So why don't we just go ahead and jump into this, everyone, as we continue our 30th anniversary Deep Space Nine rewatch with the second episode of season two, The Circle. Here is a quick rundown. The plans of the Bajoran group known as The Circle become clear thanks to an unexpected source. Quark, who has been newly christened Odo's number one deputy, Quark's words. The group is being supplied with weapons by another unexpected source, the Cardassians. Who's running the Circle? Well, that's also a bit unexpected. But one thing that is clear from the start is that Vedic Barayal has the hots for Kira. It's all set up in the middle part of Star Trek's first three-parter. So, Matthew, we're in the middle story, first time ever in Star Trek, three parts, and you've got political upheaval and intrigue and all this stuff going on. And I have to say, again, having watched this, I don't know how many times, I was watching it again to prepare for this discussion, and just given what's going on in the world right now, it just hit me right over the head again of how Deep Space Nine writing is just so relevant in the world we live in now, even though this was all written long before we could anticipate what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Chris. You know, one of the things that makes Deep Space Nine so special is that ability. You know, it's actually something, it was really interesting. I was reading an article with Tony Gilroy, who has written Andor seasons one and two, and he was talking about season two coming up and how the goal for that was he is not trying to make statements about today. He is pulling from ancient history and history in general just to create the milieu that we're in the same way that George Lucas did, right, with Star Wars. And Star Trek and Deep Space Nine does that same thing here with this series, because this whole idea of a fledgling group, you know, this nascent provisional government falling into this trap of somebody trying to take it over. And it turns out that they're actually being supported by their enemies and creating this kind of proxy war, this kind of proxy civil government, so that, you know, Federation will be thrown out and then the Cardassians could move back in when, you know, the Bajorans can't take care of themselves anymore because they're alone. Like you said, it just feels so relevant to the world we're living in now, but you can see all the implications of that through the years past, right? And so it's really very interesting to watch these characters have this discussion, right? And and I think what makes it so relevant too is that you can understand, right, the frustration that Bajorans are feeling at this moment, where their government can't even decide if it's a government.
Right.
So they call it provisional. And you can understand why somebody could take advantage of that and fan the flames of, I guess, nationalism, you could call it, in a way that's damaging instead of something that builds up, right? Because there really is something important. You know, not all nationalism is a bad thing, but the way in which, you know, you get Jarrow using it here, it is, because he's actually, his desire to help his people is not bad. It's just that the way in which he's going about this is, especially since he doesn't realize he's just being used by their arch nemesis, their arch enemies, who have had them in an occupation for 50 years. And their goal is to do it again by taking advantage of the situation here. So it's so well done.
Our friend Keith DeCandido, he did the rewatch on tour, of course, and he noted about this episode one thing about Jarrow, which was it's kind of too bad that Jarrow doesn't see the long-term repercussions of what he's doing by trying to get rid of the Federation.
Right.
But also Keith notes in there, he doesn't because the script won't allow him to. You know, obviously the story, for the story to work as it's being told, he has to not think about the repercussions, but in reality, you would expect that someone would.
Okay. And I see what Keith is saying there, but I think that that does really a disservice to Jarrow as a character, because yes, he can't see it because that's, you know, where the script has him, right? But I don't really think that that's a problem, because I think that we see in our world today, people falling into these same kind of traps, but we've seen that throughout history too.
Right. Well, that's right. Yeah,
so
for sure.
So I think that this is a excellent portrayal of a character like that, because the thing about Jarrow is that he doesn't see himself as the villain. He sees himself the savior of Bajor.
Yeah, of course.
That's what makes a villain a good villain, is somebody who doesn't see themselves as being one. And I think, you know, the biggest danger of this is then he's willing to do this at any cost, even the cost of Bajoran lives. And that's where I think the villainy part does come in for this character, but it's because he's a selfish character, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because what he longs for is the power as well. And so this isn't about altruism, about what's best for Bajor. Really, in the end, it comes down, this is what's best for Jarrow. And that's where the big dichotomy comes between him and somebody like him and Kira, who still completely believes in Bajor for Bajorans and like not having anybody else rule over them. But she's also come to see the wisdom of, you know, working alongside the Federation to allow Bajor to actually get to that point. Right.
Yeah. Well, this ties into that. There are two particular moments when I said it really struck me how relevant it is to today. And you talk about Jarrow being such a selfish character, and we see people like that here and there through history, right? But that moment at the beginning of the episode when he's in there talking to Sisko, and Sisko says, "For a minute, I was thinking to myself, there's a warm wind blowing in from Minicoy." And of course, that's not a literal reference to something that happened in history, although Minicoy is a real place, but the way it catches Jarrow off guard, and then Sisko says, "Well, you know, it's an old saying from Earth. It all started with a famous ambassador from Minicoy who used to bluster, exaggerate, and dissemble to get what he wanted. Not at all like you or me. He was a bag of hot air, and everyone recognized him for what he was." And then talking about Kira, as you mentioned, later in the episode when she's talking to Jarrow, she says, "If you want to change the government, you vote to change it. You don't sneak up from behind it with a dagger." So these two things really caught me there. But comparing Jarrow and Kira, it is I think it's really interesting in the writing what they've done here with Jaro at the start of season two, because they're mirroring Kira at the start of season one,
yes,
where he has the same view of the Federation that Kira has in Emissary, all the way down to some of the lines, like saying, you know, it's no better than the Cardassians.
No, I 100% agree with you, because, and I think that's what this episode, well, this episode does just about everything well, but this is one of the things that the episode does really well, which is to, you know, this is the beginning of season two, and we are showing just how far Kira has come from where she was at the beginning of the series. Because, you know, you get that whole moment where, and everybody keeps barging into her quarters, and it's a really beautiful moment, right? And what makes it so beautiful is that these are her friends. These are people that love her and care about her and have come to respect her, and who she, at the same time, has also been able to do. And and that is not something that she expected whatsoever to have happened to her when she was brought on the station. You know,
and you know, the way Nana Visitor delivers that line, "These are my friends," it's so perfectly delivered, because it really shows, like, Kira in the moment realizes it. Like, it's not like she didn't understand, they're her friends, I suppose, up to that point, but it, like, it hits her right then. And and she realizes also how much of a journey she's been on, and how she's progressed.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it's a great moment, because, you know, we also, again, you see that this has also happened for Sisko, right? That that Kira has become indispensable for him as a friend and as a colleague, and he is willing to fight to get her back, right? And so there's just something so nice about the way in which this series is very much said, hey, we are going to take these characters and show you that everything we did last year, we remember, and they've moved forward. Like, these characters are not the same as they were beforehand, you know, and it's very blatant, right? That's something, you know, I'm watching through TNG with my wife, and we're in the second season now. We're actually almost done with it. And those characters experience growth, right? But it's much more under the surface, and it's not as blatant and obvious as Deep Space Nine makes it for its characters by truly saying, hey, remember who our character was last season? We're going to give you a character that was like that. And now we're going to show you, then, like you were saying with Kira and Jaro, it's that's great work. And I think that it just is one of the things that makes this, you know, such a great episode, a great show. And, you know, they've done a really good job with this season so far. You know, I mean, again, we're only in the second episode, but they've done an excellent job. So,
well, they really evolved what we talked about when we talked about Duet as a turning point for Kira, and then In the Hands of the Prophets. And then they kind of closed the deal here by the middle of the story with her. Now, if you can think back to the first time that this aired, sort of the premise is that, well, maybe we're going to replace Kira and we're going to have this new character, Lee Nalis, and he's going to be the first officer. Did you ever think there was a chance that they were actually going to move Kira out of that role as the first officer of the station?
I don't think so. And a big part of that is, I think that, it's very clear that she belongs on this station, and the character means too much to the characters on the show. And I think she had come to mean too much to the audience. And so I never thought that they would ever replace her. And I'm glad that you know, it never came down to that. And but I do think, again, this is a perfect place to be able to create that moment of recognition for how far the characters come. It really does do that for not just her, but again, like every single person throughout this episode that we come across has had growth. I mean, you even think about the way in which Odo's reaction to Kira leaving. I mean, there is so much said in that scene about how he feels about her, what they mean to one another. It's great. You know, I mean, that's the type of stuff that, you know, you want to see from your show, where you are truly able to recognize that characters are moving forward. And again, I think this is where you get Deep Space Nine setting itself apart from TNG in that sense of we are going to be very overt with our character growth. And we're not going to shy away from the fact that these characters are going to grow episode by episode, season by season.
Well, that scene and the interaction between Odo and Kira, I also wanted to mention that, because knowing where that eventually goes, it's interesting to watch this now and see that interaction. And like you said, you can see how much Kira means to Odo, and we know that it will grow and grow from here. So that really stands out. Quark, one thing, I want to mention this for a couple of reasons. Also, while we're talking about Odo, so the interaction between Odo and Quark, which was always great from the very beginning, is really excellent and very natural here. But one thing that I also like is how they use Quark, because, again, we all had this image of Ferengi going into Deep Space Nine, and Quark already changed the way we think about at least him as a Ferengi in season one. But it's also easy to always use Quark as comic relief.
Yeah.
But here, you know, there are some humorous moments, like when he says we'll discuss compensation later and so forth. But, you know, really, he is the linchpin to this whole thing, because if he had not been able to learn what was going on with the weapons, probably, now maybe Odo would have eventually figured it out. He's a great sleuth, but the timing of them needing to know what's going on, not only to protect Kira and save her, but to also stop a potential coup. You know, the clock is ticking, and if they had gone through normal Starfleet channels or even Odo's methods, who knows? And so Quark is able to actually play an important role in the story and not just be there for comic relief.
Yeah. No, the role for Quark here, again, is wonderful. And I love that moment where he's like, we got to get out of here. Like, this is, it's all ending. It's all done. We're all about to die, you know, kind of thing. And I'm running for the hills. And if you're not running for the hills, you're an idiot. And then the way you have Odo talk him into this, and the beauty, this is the beauty, I think, that really makes that work, is that him talking Quark into this is talking him into the thing that he already wants, which he doesn't want to leave. He likes living here. He likes the Federation, even though he would hate to admit it. He would hate that, you know, if he were listening right now, he would hate that we're saying that, right? but he loves the Federation. Yeah. And the opportunity that they've given him. But at the same time, right, even though Quark is kind of being a sleazeball when he goes to Kira's quarters and everything, he cares about these people. They are becoming his friends. And that is one of the ways in which it's very obvious that that's happening here. And so I really, really like that this is what we're seeing for the series. And I think it's just, it's actually really, you know, well done. Again, we're talking about just the way in which you could go through kind of all of a lot of these characters and talk about the way they're growing, and it's wonderful.
Well, while we're there in Odo's office, I did want to ask you, because I know you're such a big Harry Potter fan and you've got like the moving pictures and all. Did you like the talking baseball card where Odo's getting the report from the planet. Just the framing of...
Oh, yes.
It's a screen, but the framing of it, it looks like a baseball card.
It does. It does. Do you know, though, what I loved about that? As I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, this is actually one of the most futuristic things we've actually seen on Star Trek, where the screen is just this razor thin.
Yeah, yeah.
Like... that might be one of the most futuristic things they'd ever done in Star Trek.
And then
we'd
never see it again. Right?
No, I don't think we do. And I think that that's what, again, it's just a really interesting thing that, I mean, that's where we are today. Like our TVs are razor thin, our iPads are razor thin. So to have a screen like that pop up, that's actually very legitimate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. So you mentioned that it was kind of sleazy what Quark did when he came to Kira's quarters, but it's not as sleazy as what was apparently going on down on the surface of the planet in the Arboretum with Vedic Beryl. I mean, tell me what you think about the storyline. So I feel like there's a disconnect for me in the portrayal of Vedic Beryl and what the character, the role of the character in the story itself. When he comes to Kira's quarters, it already feels uncomfortable. But when they're down in the Arboretum, just like the gaze, the kind of leering at Kira and saying, I'm getting to know you. And it was kind of creepy, to be honest. And then the orb visions, like showing her the orb, and it's a little confusing. Like, I don't know, you know, the visions come from the prophets and so forth, but he reveals to her that she was in his orb vision. And of course he was in her orb vision, although she lies and says that she didn't see him.
Yeah.
But I think when Wynn has her little quip about, you know, you deserve some recreation after everything that happened, kind of implying like, oh, you brought Kira down here, you know, to have some fun. Like the whole situation feels like, I don't want to say sexual predator, but it just feels weird the way it's portrayed, while at the same time, the actual interactions are important for the story.
Yeah.
So I don't know. How do you feel about this section of the episode?
Okay. This is a place where I don't think that the betrayal works. I think that is, I'm not going to lay blame on the actor because this is a director's call.
Yeah, the director could say that's not working.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think he could have played it completely differently. And, you know, Beryl goes on to be a more interesting character, you know, later on in the series. And so, no, I just don't think that this works very well. And yes, it just feels odd the whole time. And we don't learn specifically in this episode exactly kind of why he feels this way about her, because he's only said that, you know, he had a dream basically about her in his vision from the prophets. Therefore, we don't really get an opportunity of understanding, okay, what's happening here and why is he maybe, you know, coming off this way, which would be better if we had that, but we don't at this moment. And so, therefore, it does just come off very strange and unfortunately, yes, it does just come off creepy. And it's the one downside to the episode because the portrayal just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And again, if you had just, given some direction and said, come off more casually, just come off more nonchalant, I think all of that would have worked. But that's not the, you know, direction that he was given. And we got what we got. And unfortunately, yeah, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. I think if I think about the choice of portrayal, like what he may have been going for, in the Bajoran religion, these Vedics, they remind me a lot more of Buddhist monks than they do, you know, bishops or something in Western religions. And I think that the way he speaks when he first steps into Kira's quarters, as well as down the planet, and his movements and so forth kind of reflect that very calm nature. Everything's sure. very yeah, low absolutely. Key and calm. And you can contrast that with Wynn, who Wynn is, she's very calm and measured in how she speaks, but there's this like tension underneath all of it all the time where
yeah.
you can tell that she's not calm inside. And right. so maybe there was an effort to create a contrast between the two characters in that sense, which could work, mm-hmm. but the gazing part of it,
yeah.
it kind of undermined that if that was the goal.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. It's just, you know, I don't think anybody could call us, you know, fanboys where we're just praising everything, because this part just mm-hmm. doesn't work. And they really should have changed directions here. And it would have been better if yeah. they had.
And pairing that with the sexual imagery in the orb visions kind of reinforced it not working, right?
I mean, and this is where that would have worked if he had just played it
right.
so much cooler.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
just
yeah.
so much more nonchalant and, yeah. and truly as a person coming and saying, because I think the point of him is that he's obviously had a vision of her, mm-hmm. realizes that he needs to contact her and mm-hmm. offer her guidance, spiritual guidance, all this type of thing. But he plays it with such a, like, and you mentioned it, and I think it was the right word, this almost like predatory way. It just mm-hmm. doesn't work. So they just should have had him not do that, and it would have been great.
Yeah. You know, I said it's not clear, like, what's happening in the visions. And I think the way that the character is being portrayed is the reason, because where it creates some confusion, I feel it can create confusion, is that if he played it more cool and natural and wasn't acting like he's so attracted to her when they're just talking.
Right. Yeah.
Then you can more clearly see that those visions are coming from the prophets and they mean something. There's like some meaning that they need to unlock.
Right.
What are the prophets exactly. trying to tell us? But instead, you start wondering if somehow he has some kind of control over the vision and he's using the orbs to try mm-hmm. to get
yeah.
close to her. And I think it confuses the story.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's just not a, it's not a great choice for the portrayal, and mm. they should have gone back and they should have fixed that. And on the day of shooting, they should have just been like, hey, just play it like more like you're a guy who knows that you have a friend in need and you're coming to offer help mm-hmm. and a place to land. Basically, it's like, hey, I got a couch for you to sleep on because you got nowhere else to go
yeah.
kind of thing.
And hey, that couch could be Odo. He could just turn into a couch.
It could. I mean, yeah, there you go.
So someone else who clearly has the hots for one another is Wynn and Jaro.
Yep, definitely and, do. Yeah.
It seems like they've got something going on already. But the reason I bring it up is that the other part of the story, in addition to the Circle wanting to overthrow the provisional government, is this plot to make Wynn the next Kai, and which we know has massive repercussions for the entire story of Deep Space Nine and for the future of Bajor and Sisko and everybody. What are your thoughts on that? What's going on with Jaro and Wynn in addition to the coup efforts?
I think what's great here with Wynn is that, you know, we already knew coming in from season one and that last episode, this is a character who truly cares about power and
yeah.
is desiring to be in power and is mm-hmm. going to do whatever it takes to get in power. And I love the way that she plays it here, because, you know, she's being so coy with him about, if you're actually made minister. And he's like, well, there's no doubt of that. And you can tell she is so calculating in who she is going to give her support to, because she doesn't want to be on the wrong side, because she doesn't care about being on the right side. She only cares about being on power's side.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what makes this incredibly fascinating. And, you know, Fletcher is so good with this character and just oozes that. I mean, she comes off as the person you just kind of want to slap so hard, because she's just nasty, and she knows it, and she revels in it. And those type of people make your skin crawl. And so pairing her then with Jaro, you know that Jaro's motives are anything but pure, because he's paired with her. It's her with him that truly lets you know just how bad he actually is. That's what I think makes this pretty great. And what I love about this too is that, you know, if you're watching the episode in real time, you don't know what's going to happen yet. So you don't know where this is going to go. And yet you have a feeling deep down inside, no matter what happens, Kai Winn's going to be able to get away with something here. And it's great. I mean, it's just so well done.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned if you're watching it in real time, that's the thing. Like when it first aired, it's just this extra layer of intrigue being added to what's going on. But then when you look back at it, you see how important it is for everything that is to come in Deep Space Nine. And again, I cannot imagine anyone other than Louise Fletcher pulling this off so successfully, because there's just, even the way, I already mentioned the scene earlier, but when she's up above looking down at Kira and Barayal, it's just like
gross.
Yeah,
she's
right?
Gross.
It's
just like, ugh.
She's like, I'm watching you. I know everything you're doing.
That's terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, I thought the orb experience was terrifying. Woo! That, talk about giving me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah. All right. So the one other thing that I wanted to get your thoughts on, because this is how I feel about middle stories. I have a fondness for middle stories. I love The Empire Strikes Back in the original trilogy. I love The Search for Spock in the first three original series movies. And this story hits that same spot for me, where it's clearly a middle story, right? You come into it, you need to know everything that happened before to really get into the story. And there's no resolution at the end. It just leaves you hanging. And I like that kind of story.
Yeah, no, I think this is great. I think it's interesting that Deep Space Nine is the first Star Trek show to embrace the trilogy, which is such a popular storytelling convention. And it is interesting, too, because Deep Space Nine isn't really going to do this a ton.
Right.
But they are, I think, testing out this idea of long form kind of storytelling here, which, you know, we know in season two, we're going to get another two-parter. We'll get the two-parter with the Maquis. You know, once we get into season three, there's going to be more. And so, yeah, I really, really like the way that this is done. I think it's just great stuff. And I agree with you. You know, I really like trilogies as well. I think of, you know, I love the Two Towers and the Lord of the Rings series, whether it's the book or the movie. And so, oh my gosh, I think, you know, again, we mentioned at the top of the show a little bit, but this truly shows, I mean, Star Trek, The Next Generation, had two-parters, and it had, you know, a few two-parters throughout its run. And yet this is like Deep Space Nine just flexing a muscle that Star Trek has never used before.
Mm-hmm.
And this is only the beginning of that. Because Deep Space Nine obviously will really flex that muscle, especially as you get into the later seasons where you're going to have episodes that it's basically five, six, seven part arcs, you know.
Well, the final, so, what is it, 10? Yeah, the ride at the end is like.
And I think what's fascinating about this too is that there are other shows that would then kind of pick up this idea. The Clone Wars really started to use this format in its later seasons where it would do three-part arcs. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Enterprise picks up on this, you know, where it does its three-part arcs in the fourth season, which, you know, it really does work as, again, as a storytelling convention. So I love that this is what we got. You know, it's just great stuff.
Yeah. And in this case, what this shows is that this story needed three parts, not two, to air it out enough to be able to tell the story. And especially, I mean, it's so, especially this episode, it's so Kira-centric. And because they had three episodes to work with for the overall story, they're able to give Kira all this time in this episode where they would have to condense that a lot if they only had a two-parter to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. To give you another book example that's not from Star Trek, the Arthur C. Clarke wrote Rendezvous with Rama, and then many, many years later, there was a trilogy written that he wrote with Gentry Lee. It's Rama 2, The Garden of Rama, and Rama Revealed. And The Garden of Rama is probably my favorite book in that newer trilogy. So again, it's like the middle story. Maybe because it is very character heavy because it kind of takes place on this ship throughout the book. So, all right. Well, what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for The Circle?
I mean, I think that this is a very good episode. Obviously, this episode is hampered with what you got with the whole Beryl section of the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, it does not quite work as well in that sense. And so, even though I enjoy this one, it's a little bit, instead of being like a 4, it's like a 3.75 because there's just that I don't enjoy Beryl enough that it kind of derails some of the episode. But on a whole, I mean, what we're doing here with the story and where we're going is incredibly interesting. And it's, you truly are feeling the weight of what's happening for these characters and for Bajor, for the Federation. I mean, the idea of, you know, this goes up against the Prime Directive, which is you know, we always hate getting into the Prime Directive conversations, especially when you also think of the idea that they were asked to be here, right? You know,
right.
And now that this is all being thrown in whack, and especially when you know behind the scenes that the Cardassians are the one doing this, this is what I think makes this so interesting to me. And so, yeah, I mean, I just think it's a really, really good episode. And what a great start to season two. And especially since at this point, you know, when you think back in history, Deep Space Nine didn't have the numbers that TNG did. And this is very much, I think, where Deep Space Nine was saying, yeah, we're going to do our thing. You know, we're just going to do our thing. So,
yeah. So what's your rating?
Yeah. 3.75 out of 5 creepy orb experiences.
Oh, wow. That's about all I can handle of creepy orb experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. So one thing I learned in this episode is that it is very difficult to lay a stone path across a pond. It's even harder than finger painting. And perspective matters when you're doing that. And the other thing is when I watched this episode, every time, and we didn't talk about this section, but when Sisko goes and he meets General Krim in the super fancy, you know, for this kind of like undercover group, the Circle, they have a really fancy command center for their operations. But
yeah,
when he walks in there and he says, "General Krim," I always hear in my head, "Cardinal Fang?" from Monty Python's Spanish Inquisition sketch. I just expect Sisko to walk in and go, "Trouble at the mill." It's just something about the way he says that. I always think about that. But no, like I said, I think this is a great story because I love middle stories, and it's a wonderful story for Kira. It is harmed a little bit by the portrayal of Beryl that we've discussed, but I think what it does for the Federation's role or Starfleet's role at the station, why they're there to help Bajor, the precarious situation that the Bajorans are actually in, but they don't realize it.
Yes.
And the way it sets all of this stuff up, not only for the next episode to resolve the story, but it's sort of like, I think this trilogy, it's almost like a cleanser for the DS9 story, because you've got like Sisko didn't want to be there. You get through the first season, they've kind of settled in. Now there's this big road bump, this big obstacle they've got to get over. But once they get past it, the whole mission becomes a bit more stable. But then you've got this thorn still there in the side of Sisko and the Federation in the form of Wynn that's going to carry forward. So I think it's a really great story for putting the series on solid footing. And so I'm going to give this one 8 botanical DNA traders.
Well, and I just wanted to say that too, Chris, as you were mentioning, that whole idea is this palate cleanser. I think the other thing that this does is it really embraces the storytelling that only Deep Space Nine can do, with the characters then really shining in all the stories that are coming up. I mean, we're going to tell stories about Dax. We're going to tell more stories about Kira. We're going to tell stories about the Ferengi. And you know, season two is really going to start digging into the characters of Deep Space Nine and the stories for those characters. And so I think that's, you know, in the end, in a lot of ways, that's kind of what you need from this show, especially since, you know, you're crossing over with TNG. Voyager is going to begin. You need to be able to find your own identity.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everyone. Well, we would love to hear your thoughts on The Circle. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. It's there to extend the conversation beyond the podcasts. So we'd like to build a community there. You'll find a post on the timeline for this episode, and you can leave your comments for Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there on that post. You can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show. Choose the orb, and that will come to us by email. And of course, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not turning into a rat and sneaking around, where can people find you?
Wow, that seems really personal. But you can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, you can find me at the 602 Club, talking about all those franchises outside of Star Trek we love, plus a lot of great Star Trek talk with you, Chris, and hopefully everybody will check those out. You can also find me over in the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One's called Owl Post with Drea Kaufman, as we talk about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and Aggressive Negotiations, where John Mills and I talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, if people just can't get enough of hearing you on our podcast and they're like, I've got to reach out to this man, where can they find you?
Well, I am working with OpenAI to turn my voice into one of those little things where you can just chat with me anytime you want. I'm just kidding. I'm not doing that. But
yeah, that's terrifying.
Right? Imagine if I did that, and then that's the voice I used when I... That would be So bizarre. But no, you can find me elsewhere on the network. As you mentioned, doing all of those shows with you. You can also find me in many, many episodes of many shows in the back catalog. You can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. I'd love to chat with you there. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support. So thank you so much to everyone who is helping us now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time when we will close out this three-parter and find out just what happens to a Navark.
Well, Chris, I can't wait for that to happen, but thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.